Coming up, what an excellent day for a hello.
And a goodbye.
And a goodbye?
Mm-hmm.
What? What do you mean a goodbye?
Let's see.
Well, howdy, folks, and welcome to Minute 121 of The Exorcist Minute, a show where we endeavor to examine, extrapolate, and excavate The Exorcist, minute by terrifying minute. My name is Lester Ryan Clark.
And I'm Keenan Diaz.
And we'll be your holy guides on this journey through what some have called the scariest movie of all time. Okay, so our minute begins with Chris going to answer the door.
And it ends with Dimmy turning to look at a laughing Captain Howdy.
Yes, folks, what is Captain Howdy laughing about? We will find out all too soon, but for now, let's open our books. It's time for a reading from the Book of Blatty. All right, folks, and just for context, this is right after Dimmy has been sent out of Reagan's room. So here we go. With a lump rising dry to his throat, Karis turned and left the bedroom, and for a time he stood in the hallway, weak and irresolute. Coffee? He craved it. But a shower even more. But when he left the McNeil house and returned to his room in the residence hall, it took only one look at his bed for Karis to change his priorities. Forget the shower, man. Sleep. Half an hour. As he reached for the telephone to ask reception to give him a wake-up call, it rang. Yes, hello, Karis answered hoarsely.
Someone here to see you, Father Karis. A Mr. Kinderman?
Karis briefly held his breath, and then he exhaled in resignation. Okay, tell him I'll be out in just a minute, he said weakly. As he hung up the telephone, Karis saw a carton of non-filter Camel cigarettes on his desk. A note from Dyer was attached. A key to the Playboy Club has been found on the chapel kneeler in front of the votive lights. Is it yours? You can claim it at reception. Joe. With a fond expression, Karis set down the note, quickly dressed in fresh clothing, and walked out of the room to reception, where Kinderman was standing at the telephone switchboard counter, delicately rearranging the composition of a vase full of flowers. As he turned and saw Karis, he was holding the stem of a pink camellia.
Ah, Father, Father Karis,
Kinderman greeted him cheerfully, his expression quickly changing to concern when he saw the exhaustion in the Jesuit's face. He replaced the camellia and came forward to meet him.
You look awful, he said. What's the matter? That's what comes of all this schlepping around the track. Give it up, Father. You're going to die anyway. Listen, come.
He gripped Karis by the elbow and an upper arm and propelled him toward the exit to the street.
You got a minute?
He asked as they passed through the door. Just barely, Karis murmured. What is it?
A little talk. I need advice. Nothing more. Just advice.
What about?
In just a minute. For now, we'll just walk. We'll take air. We'll enjoy.
He hooked his arm through the Jesuit's and guided him diagonally to the other side of the street.
Ah, now look at that. Beautiful, gorgeous.
He was pointing to the sun sinking low on the Potomac. And in the stillness, sudden laughter rang out. And then, the talking altogether of Georgetown undergraduates in front of a drinking hall near the corner of 36th Street. One punched another hard on the arm, and the two began amicably wrestling.
Ah, college, breathed out Kinderman ruefully as he glanced at the lively gathering of young men.
I never went, but I wish. Turning his gaze back to Karis, he frowned with concern.
I mean, seriously, you look bad, he said.
What's the matter? You been sick?
When would Kinderman come to the point? Karis wondered.
No, just busy, the Jesuit answered. Slow it down, then, wheezed Kinderman.
Slow. You saw the Bolshoi Ballet, incidentally, at the Watergate?
No. No, me neither. But I wish. They're so graceful. So cute.
They had come to the car barn's low stone wall, where the view of the sunset was unimpeded, and they stopped, Karis resting a forearm on the top of the wall and turning his glance from the sunset to Kinderman.
Okay, what's on your mind? Karis asked him.
Ah, well, Father, said Kinderman, sighing. He turned, hunching forward with his hands clasped on the top of the wall as he moodily stared across the river and said, I'm afraid I've got a problem.
Professional?
Well, partly. Only partly.
What is it?
Well, mostly it's...
Kinderman hesitated, then continued.
Well, mostly it's ethical, you could say, Father Karis.
A question, his voice trailing off. The detective turned around and, leaning his back against the wall, he looked down at the sidewalk and frowned.
There's just no one I could talk to about it,
Not my captain in particular, you see. I just couldn't. I couldn't tell him. So I thought, here. Abruptly, the detective's eyes lit up. I had an aunt. You should hear this. It's funny. She was terrified, terrified for years of my uncle. The poor woman, she never dared to say a word to him. Never. Much less to ever raise her voice. So whenever she got mad at him for something, right away, she'd run quick to the closet in her bedroom, and then there, in the dark, you won't believe this, in the dark, by herself, with all the clothes hanging up and the moths, she would curse. She would curse at my uncle and tell him what she thought of him for maybe 20 minutes. Really, I mean, yelling. She'd come out, she'd feel better, she'd go kiss him on the cheek. Now, what is that, Father Karras? That's good therapy or not? It's very good, Karras answered with a wan, bleak smile. And I'm your closet now? Is that what you're saying? In a way, the detective answered gravely, but more serious. And the closet must speak. Got a cigarette? Kinderman stared at Karras blankly, incredulous. A condition like mine and I would smoke? No, you wouldn't, Karras murmured, as he turned to face the river and clasp his hands atop the wall. It was to make them stop trembling. Some doctor. God forbid I should be sick in some jungle, and instead of Albert Schweitzer, there's with me only you. You cure warts still with frogs, Dr. Karras? It's toads, Karras answered, subdued. Kinderman frowned. You're not smiling jaunty jolly today, Father Karras. Something wrong? Now what is it? Come on, tell me. Karras lowered his head and was silent. Then, okay, he said softly. Ask the closet whatever you want. Sighing, the detective faced out to the river. I was saying, he began. He scratched his brow with a thumbnail, then continued. I was saying, well, let's say I'm working on a case, Father Karras. It's a homicide. Dennings? No, you wouldn't be familiar with it, Father. It's something purely hypothetical. Got it. Like a ritual witchcraft murder, this looks, the detective continued broodingly, picking his words very carefully and slowly. And let us say that in this house, this hypothetical house, there are living five people, and that one must be the killer. With his hand, he made flat, chopping motions of emphasis. Now, I know this. I know this. I know this for a fact. Then he paused, slowly exhaling breath. But then the problem. All the evidence. Well, it points to a child, Father Karras. A little girl, maybe 10, 12 years old. Just a baby. She could maybe be my daughter. Yes, I know. Sounds fantastic. Ridiculous. But true. Now, there comes to this house, Father Karras, a very famous Catholic priest. And this case being purely hypothetical, Father, I learn through my also hypothetical genius that this priest has once cured a very special type illness, an illness which is mental, by the way, a fact I mention just in passing for your interest. Karras mournfully lowered his head and nodded. Yes, go on, he said bleakly. What else? What else? A great deal. It also seems that there is, well, Satanism involved in this illness, plus also strength. Yes, incredible strength. And this hypothetical girl, let us say, then, could so easily twist a man's head around. Head lowered. The detective was nodding now. Yes. Yes, she could. And so the question, breaking off. The detective grimaced thoughtfully, then went on. You see, this girl is not responsible, Father. She's insane, Father. Totally demented. And also just a child, Father Karras, a child. And yet, the illness that she has, it could be dangerous. She could kill someone else. Who's to know? Once again, the detective turned and squinted out across the river. It's a problem, he said quietly and morosely. What to do? Hypothetically, I mean. Just forget it? Forget it and hope she gets... Kinderman paused. Gets well? He reached for a handkerchief and blew his nose. Ah, well, I just don't know. I don't know. It's a terrible decision, he said as he searched for a clean, unused section of the handkerchief. Yes, it's awful. Just awful. Horrific. And I hate to be the one who has to make it. He again blew his nose, lightly dabbed at a nostril, then stuffed the damp handkerchief back into the pocket. Father, what would be right in such a case? He asked, turning back to Karras. Hypothetically, I mean. What do you believe would be the right thing to do? For an instant, Karras throbbed with a surge of rebellion, with a dull, weary anger at the piling on of weight upon weight. He let it ebb away into calm and firmly meeting the detective's gaze, he answered softly, "I would put it in the hands of a higher authority. I believe it is there at this moment." "Yes, and I would leave it there, Lieutenant." For some moments later, their gazes stayed locked. Then Kinderman nodded, saying, "Yes, Father, yes, yes. I thought you would say that." He turned to again observe the sunset. "So beautiful," he said. "And so what makes us think such a thing has beauty while the Leaning Tower of Pisa does not? Also, lizards and armadillos, another mystery." He tugged back his sleeve for a look at his wristwatch. "Ah, well, I have to go. Any minute, Mrs. K will be shrying that the dinner is cold." He turned back to Karis. "Thank you, Father. I feel better. Much better. Oh, incidentally, you could maybe do a favor. Give a message? If by chance you should ever meet a man, last name Engstrom, please tell him, well, just say to him, Elvira is in a clinic. She's all right. He'll understand. Would you do that? I mean, if by some crazy chance you should meet him." Faintly puzzled, Karis answered, "I will." "Look, we could make a film some night, Father." Karis cast his eyes down and, nodding, murmured, "Soon." "You're like a rabbi when he mentions the Messiah. Always soon. Listen, do me yet another favor, please, would you?" Glancing up, Karis saw that the detective looked gravely concerned. "Stop running around the track for a little. Just walk. Okay, Father? Slow it down. Could you do that for me, please?" Karis smiled faintly and said, "I will." Hands in the pockets of his coat, the detective looked down at the sidewalk in resignation. "Yes, I know," he said, nodding. "Soon. Always soon." As he started away, he stopped, reached up a hand to the Jesuit's shoulder, and squeezed, saying, "Elia Kazan, your director, sends his regards." For a time, Karis watched him as he listed down the street, watched with fondness and with wonder at the heart's labyrinthine turnings and improbable redemptions. He looked up at the clouds, washed in pink above the river, then beyond to the west, where they drifted at the edge of the world, glowing faintly like a promise remembered. There had been a time when he often saw God in such sights, felt his breath in the tinting of clouds, as now the lines of a poem he'd once loved returned to haunt him. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brindled cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal chestnut falls, finches wings, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. Karis pressed the side of a fist against his lips and looked down against the sadness and the pain of loss welling up from his throat toward the corners of his eyes, as he thought of a line from a psalm that once filled him with joy. "O Lord," he remembered achingly, "I have loved the beauty of thy house." Karis waited, dared not risk another glance at the sunset. But yeah, what do we think of this? I mean, every time I read it, you know, I can't help but get choked up. It's this beautiful budding friendship. But then at the same time, it's right at the climax. He shows up and it just kind of like brings everything to a halt. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, for me, when I read the book, you know, the last 50 pages, including this, just flew by. So I think that's just, you know, how a book can work. You're just like, oh, God, you know, and maybe, I don't know, maybe even I was skimming. I can't remember, you know, like this. Yeah, so it doesn't feel like you have control over whether it's really breaking up the pace, really, right? In a movie, no, that wouldn't happen. That would be so deadly in the movie. But I do like this idea of Kinderman presenting Karis the agency to decide what Kinderman is going to do. I think that's super interesting, and how he's communicating him, and you know, that's Blatty's take with Kinderman, right? That Kinderman takes a long ass time to get to whatever he's going to talk about. So even Karis, as you're reading, is like, when is Kinderman going to get to why he's dragging me out of this dorm, and what is going on here?
Yeah. Kinderman is a fast worker, but a slow talker. You know what I mean? Like he figured out the answer to this riddle real quick.
Right.
But most of his time is spent kind of convincing himself to move forward with what he thinks he has to do.
Right. I had a filmmaker friend of mine was talking about their producer, who in many ways was super, super good, like all these skills. And one of the things the producer would do would be like to draw consensus, right? So like before they started shooting, it's like, so let's sit and let's think about like what our options here and what the different constituencies are going to feel based on this decision or that decision, you know, which is all these different skills. But then during production, that same producer, you know, there'd be things going on and it would just stop the rhythm of the whole momentum of the show. Just like, now let's all think about this and everyone, let's be very calm. Right. And then they brought on like for a day or a weekend, I can't remember what the story was, like a different line producer. And they were just like, okay, we have to do this and this and this and this. So you're going to do this and you're going to do this and you're going to do this. And like, oh, thank God. Like it's just a different set of skills, you know, in these different positions. Like maybe you wouldn't want the second producer in a boardroom meeting, you know, or.
Right.
Or talking to the press or something.
And they can be good for different times. It's like the appropriate, you know, when you're kind of when the thing is blossoming creatively,
right.
you can have that time to like breathe and think about it and kind of like get everybody's you know, ideas together. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once it's go time, it's go time, you know.
So Kinderman is a development executive. Perfect.
There you go.
Let's just sit and think. What are we trying to get at the heart of this, really? Let's not. And yeah, and then even like Kinderman, as you're reading, right, it's like stop running. Why the running?
Yeah.
And you're like, no, because there's a demon.
Yeah.
We gotta run.
I have questions about like, well, I mean, I guess we'll talk about it a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe as soon as the next minute, because we got him, you know, running up to the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I have questions about like what he thinks of this whole thing later on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in any case, let us get back to the top of this minute. You'll remember Dimmy had just ascended up to the second floor, up into the clouds via that stairway to heaven. Once we separate those episodes, people aren't going to know what the hell we're talking about.
That's right.
Yeah. And down here on Earth, our peace had been interrupted by these brazen, jarring, urgent rings of the doorbell. Someone is here. We talked before about how in Shakespeare plays, knocking was never a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was never good news. I think the most famous instance is in Macbeth, where knocking is actually a recurring motif, and every time it's just more bad news.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually where we get the phrase, knock, knock, who's there?
Really? In Macbeth?
It's from Macbeth, yes.
So,
in the scene, the porter hears a knocking at the gate, and he says, knock, knock, who's there in the name of Beelzebub? He's a farmer that hanged himself. Hilarious. But this actually fascinates me, and I looked around to see if we could maybe extend this to all cinema, or even just like stories in general. I know there's got to be exceptions, of course, but in all the stories I can think of, the knocking of a door, or by extension, the ringing of a doorbell, or let's just go all the way, the ringing of a phone, is always followed by this feeling of, what now? I think naturally, story-wise, it's the easiest way to disrupt the flow of the scene. I think that is at the heart of it. I'm workshopping this as I go. It's something that comes from outside without warning, and it brings whatever's happening inside to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
Someone or something from outside has altered your schedule without your permission because it doesn't respect schedules. Right? Like time waits for no man, death comes to all, the devil is no respecter of persons, man proposes, God disposes, you know, it's fate stepping in and changing the game without your consent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
it's an interruption, I suppose.
Yes, an interruption.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Keenan, we played with this. We tried to think of instances where it was good news, but all the instances we thought of, good news also complicated things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my estranged mother has decided to come to my wedding after all, and she wants to reconnect with me, but my father, who she really hates, is also going to be there. So even when it's good news, it's bad news.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or they subvert it, right? I'm thinking of like Nanny McPhee. I'm thinking of Mrs. Doubtfire, Gandalf in Fellowship, or this movie with Father Merrin. We get that knock or that ring at the door, and before we realize it's a good person, there's this tension like, oh, who's it going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like movies have told us, it's always gonna be a bad person, right?
Yeah, maybe that's why I don't answer any knocks on my door.
Exactly.
At all, if I'm not expecting, or even if I am expecting somebody, even if they're texting me and they're like, "Hey, I'm here, like you asked, let me in." Say, no.
Fool me once.
right. I've seen Anaconda. That might be an Anaconda uh-huh. out there.
Yeah. I know how this goes.
I don't remember if the Anaconda in Anaconda opens any doors or knocks on any doors, but I don't want to find out.
Yeah. One thing I did learn from movies is mm-hmm. that when you think something can't open doors.
Yeah. Well, if anyone says out loud, don't worry, anacondas can't open doors.
See, but Keenan, then you know how to cancel it out. You're mm-hmm. like, don't worry, anacondas didn't suddenly enter the job force and learn how to sell homeowners insurance.
But the anaconda would be like, they'd be very good at the homeowners insurance game.
Yes.
Because they'd be like, it's such a nice house you've got here. It would be a shame if something happened to it.
Are you okay? Is there something wrong with you?
No, I just really need this commission.
This commission's.
Yes.
That's a try hard snake.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just like adding S's where there ain't no S's. He's a try hard salesman and a try hard snake.
Right.
It's like, you know, the way you, that's what they say, right? The way you do one thing is the way you do everything. Right?
Yes.
Oh. Our snake salesman came so late in the game.
Well, yeah, because he does know how to knock on doors. Yeah. He had to train himself, right? Because he has to use the twist the middle part of his body to form a fist. And
yeah,
it kind of, you know how they do? It kind of rotates around really slowly and then.
Exactly. So when he rolls up on a house with like one of those like pulley doorbells, he's like, thank God.
That's right.
Or he's like, thank God. I love that just like our horseman, he uh-huh. is a snake salesman.
Right.
But he is not a man selling snakes.
No, of course not.
No, no.
That's
that
ridiculous.
Would be ridiculous. Do you also picture him with a suit and a little like 50s
yes.
hat?
Okay. Yes. A little tie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he comes prepared.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a little briefcase somehow. When you by the time you open the door, you don't see how he's been carrying the briefcase. It's just sitting on the stoop.
Yes.
You don't want to ask.
No. Oh, the snake. I hope he gets that commissions.
Yeah, but you're not buying anything from him.
No, so
he's
hope
somebody
no.
else does.
No. It's the bystander effect. Like somebody else will help him.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, okay. In any case, folks, back to this movie. Before we see who it is at mm-hmm. the door, before Chris even moves to answer the door, we cut and we realize we have followed Dimmy upstairs. Not only that, but it's the same angle from back when Dimmy decided to go in there alone.
Mm-hmm.
I actually went back and I compared the shots. It seems like maybe this one is a little bit lighter.
Yeah.
I can't tell if that's the actual lighting or whatever post-production stuff they might have done. And also, Dimmy is not walking straight down the mm-hmm. center of the hallway like in the first shot. He is entering at an angle, but it is a quick cut. Only 3 seconds or so. He doesn't even get to the door before we cut back downstairs. And now the camera is moving in on Chris as she moves to the door. We get right up close on her so that everything else disappears, which I love. Mm-hmm. It's like everything else, the rest of the house is out of sight, out of mind, as we focus on the answering of this door. I think it's the movie's way of telling us that this moment with Chris is the more important moment right now. And I think if the movie hadn't told us that this moment was the important moment, we'd still be wondering about Dimmy, because that's the important door.
Right.
And that's the scary door.
Right. We're here to be scared.
Right.
Yeah, but our camera is moving around and moving with Chris, but then also going across her shoulder to get a different side of the line.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like forget all of that stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's because the camera moves in almost like we're Sharon or Willie or Carl, and we're getting close to Madame to protect her from whatever has come calling. We're right behind her, looking over her shoulder. It's a masterful bit of misdirection by Billy, because he knows we're all thinking of the other door.
Mm-hmm.
But he's somehow made this one more important in this moment.
That's a good point. Like, this is scary. Like, it worries me, right? She's going here, like, who's on this door? But it can't be Howdy.
No.
Or could it?
Or could it?
Right?
No, the answer is no. I don't think
Okay.
But no, do you see what I mean, Keenan? It's like, why are we caring at all about who's at the front door?
Right.
When our guy has just walked back up there to face a demon in the most famous, most problematic, most scary door in this whole movie.
Yeah. So unless this is the Wicked Witch of the West opening up here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Unless this is
Darth Vader, and we're like, who are you? I am Darth Vader. I haven't been invented yet.
I was going to say, it's Pazuzu's dad.
Right.
Can you go up there and tell him it's dinner time?
Right.
Back in ancient Mesopotamia. Mother's worried sick about him. Or it's Father Marin, and he just puts a finger to his lips. He's like, shh, shh, I put a body up there. You must be very, very quiet now. We're just going to wait and get his reaction on film. It will get so many likes, so many views. And this will help my daughter, how? Oh, no, trust me.
Right. We're building our brand.
Yes. The Exorcist TM. Step one, build the brand. And what's the second step? There is only one. Like and subscribe and give me 5 stars. Yeah. But I think we agree, right? Like, this is really masterfully done, that he has that Billy has somehow made us forget about the door upstairs.
Yeah, they've given all this emphasis, so pay attention to this right now, nothing else.
Yeah. So Chris reaches up and undoes the latch even as we are moving into position behind her. After undoing the latch, she does the thing that I feel a lot of our characters have done. We've noted it before, but I don't think we've remarked how everybody is doing it, either like right before opening a door or right after closing a door. Our characters do this thing where they touch the door with the other hand. They either lean up against it or they run their hand down its length. I'm thinking of Sharon when the doctors come to the house and she's showing them into Reagan's room. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Marin when he closes the bathroom door or the bedroom door. Chris does this when Kinderman leaves for the first time right before the crucifix scene. And she does it here before opening the door. She sort of runs her fingers down the crack in the double front doors and sort of stops and leans on it before turning the knob and opening it.
Mm-hmm.
And she does it slowly so that her hand is still in between touching both doors. Like, her fingers have now become the latch that holds them together.
Mm-hmm.
And so she doesn't want to open it to a point where she can't also feel the other door.
Right. They're all just so tired.
Yeah.
But that's a really interesting point, because yes, we get to go scene by scene and notice this recurring motif. I don't know. It's probably just not possible that all of the actors came independently to this idea, right? This must have been...
It can't be. That's too much of a coincidence.
Yeah. It must have been Friedkin guiding them towards that.
Right.
Or maybe, you know what? No, I was going to say, or just tiring them the fuck out in real life. But we don't have reports like that, like we do on The Shining, right?
Right.
Of doing hundreds of takes of one scene and tiring them out. Or
yeah.
Do you know this?
I might. Yeah.
No, not the Shining. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
So do you know this story of Olivier in his first movie? He was doing Wuthering Heights, and so he's major, famous Shakespearean. He's Olivier, right?
Yeah.
But William Wyler, another William, Willy Wyler. He has this scene, the first thing they're shooting of Olivier, and it's just him looking at the fireplace, mm-hmm. and they do it over and over and over and over again. Wow. Olivier's like, what is this? And Violet tells him he's trying to get rid of all that theater stuff and just get him to just be here at this fireplace, you know?
Wow. I like how, like, in other situations, it's like, we went through 15 doors, we went through, 20 ceilings, but this one, it's like, they heated every room in the house.
Building fireplace after fireplace to get Olivier how to act in films, but thank goodness.
No, we don't
they
have
did.
Time to relight it. Just build another one.
Yeah, exactly. We're not made of logs, but we are made of rooms.
Yes.
And then there's this similar one with Jack Lemmon, who at that time had already won an Oscar, but he's working with Billy Wilder. So this is all Billy's, all Billy's and Willie's here.
It's always the Billy's.
Yeah, Billy Wilder keeps telling Jack Lemmon to do less, which is not a note that actors like to hear, but it's sometimes very necessary. Right? So he's like, less, Jack, let's do it again. Less, Jack, let's do it again. And Jack Lemmon thinks he's doing less and less. And then he finally explodes and he says, Billy, if I didn't need less, I wouldn't be doing anything. And Billy Wilder turns to everyone and says, finally, he understands it.
Yeah, I mean, like, that just makes me think of, I need to, I've been really, really bad at posting things that I say I'm going to post in the listening group. Yeah. So I'm going to do that. But I need to post, if it's still on YouTube, the acting in film Michael Caine thing. Because, like, To the point that you're making, Keenan, I mean, like, there's that part in this class that he is teaching, where he kind of has a student do a scene, and then the student steps aside, and then Michael Caine steps in, does the same scene, has the camera trained right on his face, and all he does, it's just this little flick of the eyes away from the person when he says the trigger thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in the class is like, oh, right? It's like, it speaks volumes, right? Mm-hmm. It's just tiny, tiny, tiny little things, right? And he calls the camera, he says it's like the most devoted lover.
Right.
Right? It's just like knows every inch of your face.
Right. So, yeah, we don't have reports of Billy Friedkin tiring people out like that. We just have, reports of him slapping them on the face.
Right. Tiring them out a different way.
Right. Shooting guns. But yeah. So he must have been guiding them towards this in some way.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about. Yeah. But then we're talking about Von Sydow and Burstyn and Kitty Wynn doing it. And yeah. It just doesn't seem possible that they just all come to that conclusion.
Yeah. Everybody putting their hand up either before or after the door. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, and folks, by this point, we are very close. We are right behind her, looking over her shoulder so that we get a clear view of whatever is on the other side of that door.
Mm-hmm.
And we are met with I think my first description of him in this show was craggy, frowning face of Lieutenant William F. Kinderman, which, I don't know, I'm going to defer to you, Keenan. We see him just long enough to register that it's him before cutting away. I like that choice because it shakes us up. Friedkin has managed to somehow make us forget that Dimmy was walking towards the most important door in the movie. We stayed down here with Chris. We were completely invested in protecting Madam from whatever's at the front door. And now we see it's Kinderman. What was your first thought upon seeing his face? And what do you think Billy was going for? What do you think the 1973 audience in the theater was supposed to feel? Because my first time watching it all the way through, I didn't really pay attention to the Kinderman stuff or the Burke stuff. I was focused entirely on Chris, Reagan, Karis, Marin. So when Chuck comes in and says that Burke is dead, I'm like, wait, which one is Burke? And that was okay because Ellen Burstyn made us feel something in that scene with her reaction. And I remember here, Chris opens the door and it's Kinderman. And my first thought way back in middle school, mainly because of Lee J. Cobb's expression here, was, oh no, time has run out. But time for what? I didn't know. I clearly remember not being sure if this was one of the doctors, a member of the church, or the police. I mean, he is the police, but I had not picked up that he was investigating the murder, probably because I watched this movie alongside with a bunch of other horror films that year where people were dying left and right. Nobody's investigating them. They're just disposable bodies. So when I first saw this movie and he shows up at the door, I was at the same time like, oh no, but also like, wait, what? So how about you?
Yeah, I wish I remembered my very first interaction with this film. I really don't. I don't remember. So I don't know. I just see him coming in. It's like, this is no good. I guess I don't know why I feel that though. Like, you know, what's going to happen? He's going to go up there and stop the exorcism,
right?
Or he's going to see that this little girl is possessed. I guess that's bad, but but I don't know. At the same time, like, you know, maybe you could use some help up there. We've seen where it's been getting you so far,
right,
which is
right.
Nothing. But yeah, it's definitely a feeling of like, this is no good. We got this guy coming in. And talking about, you know, I think you did your last reading. No, not your last reading of him, because he ends the book with Kinderman. So never mind. But in the book, he's constantly coming back. So he's only been to the house once before in the movie. So he's only done one time where he's been like really butting in where he's not supposed to be. So I don't know if we had, you know, done a one for one and every single scene from the book is in the movie, maybe at this point where there's the door ring, be like, oh, well, that's Kinderman.
Yeah,
because that's sort of his thing, right?
We'd feel slightly annoyed. We'd be like, not now, Kinderman.
Right.
But here, so you're saying the absence of those other visits maybe gives us a little bit more of a sense of foreboding, like, oh no, the detective's back.
Yes. Well, first it's like, this could be anybody like you're talking about.
Right.
And then it's, yeah, this guy's here, and this could only be for bad reasons here.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, wait, but we didn't get to, what does it say in the book? Do you remember, like, when he shows up here in this scene?
That's what this is. That's what that book reading was.
But he doesn't go to the house in the book reading.
Right.
So he doesn't come into the book. So he doesn't come to the house in the book during this climax.
Right. So in the book, Karis goes back to the residence hall.
Right.
And takes a break.
Right.
Like, that's where he is. You know, and then he gets the phone call from the front desk saying that Kinderman is there to see him. So I guess I'm being unfair saying that Kinderman interrupts the momentum of the scene in the book, because he doesn't. Dimmy does. Dimmy goes all the way back to the residence.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Yeah, so in the script, there's a scene that Blatty writes, and they might have filmed it. It feels like Lee J. Cobb and Ellen Burstyn in the movie are ready to get into a scene here. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, they might have filmed it. But this is Interior McNeil House Foyer. Chris hears the front door chimes. She reacts, wait, they ring again. She goes to answer. She opens the door, disclosing Kinderman. I'm sorry to disturb. He halts, eyeing her bruise. She knows what he's staring at. She puts a hand to the bruise. He stares for a beat, then... Look, I'm sorry to disturb you at this hour of the night, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to talk to your daughter, Mrs. McNeil, and I'd like to take a look at her room if you don't mind. Reagan's bedroom? Yes, immediately, please. I have a warrant. Oh, please, not now. She's gotten worse, Lieutenant. Please, please, not now. So he actually comes with the warrant, and so he's there with the reason. So that might be what Lee J. Cobb is playing here, that he's coming there with the warrant, to arrest her or at least to investigate, et cetera. Right. But then we never see that play out in the movie.
Right.
So he looks glowering and craggy and frowny, but maybe he's just there to stop by and help, or maybe he's there to say hello. And then he's there when the climax happens.
Wow. Okay, so we're presented with three possibilities, right? Once again, we've got that unholy trinity. We've got what happens in the movie, what happens in the book, and what happens in the screenplay. Of these three, I personally like what happens in the movie here. Mm-hmm. How about you?
Yeah, just kind of getting there and we're like, uh-oh, that's scary. But then we don't have time to think about that. We go upstairs. Right. This whole action thing happens. We assume maybe in the back of our head that it's going to, parallel action. We're going to get back to Kinderman, et cetera. That doesn't happen.
Sure.
But then it explains why he's there at the end. Uh-huh. And it's very neat, very clean, very condensed.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to think what you just read from the screenplay was what was going to happen when Chris opened the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But everything's just happening so fast that, we immediately get... Maybe that is the thing that's playing out as Dimmy is discovering whatever he discovers up there.
Right, exactly.
Right. But I think that's... Rather than them meeting at the residence or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. But so let's get back to the movie. Whatever we're supposed to feel, we should also feel tricked by this brilliant sleight of hand, because right as the appearance of Kinderman puts us off balance, we cut back to the upstairs hall. Yes, remember that hall and that door? How could we have forgotten? We left Dimmy walking back down that hallway, and now we go back to him. But time has passed, and Dimmy has already reached the door, opened it, and is standing frozen in the hallway, transfixed on whatever fresh horror is in there now. It's very clearly a mirror to that first time a few minutes ago when we went into that room alone.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not alone this time, right?
Yeah. Well, there should be two other people in there.
Right, at least two other people. I mean, going by what I believe... many. But before we follow him in, I want to talk about this whole sequence up to this point. I love this intercutting. We're watching our two main characters go to their respective doors. And it's interesting how we see Dimmy start up the stairs. That's in the last minute. We see Chris notice the doorbell. We cut to Dimmy. Time has jumped a little. He's now going down that hallway. And now cut back to Chris. And time has also jumped for her. She's already halfway to the door. We didn't see her start to go to the door. I don't know why that fascinates me. Mm-hmm. I know Friedkin is communicating something here, like, see how they're both heading to a door? But he's made deliberate choices of what parts of Chris answering the door you're going to see and what parts of Dimmy answering his door you're going to see. We see Chris notice the doorbell, but we don't see her start moving. We see Dimmy heading there, but we don't see him opening it. It's such a little thing. And I feel like anybody else would be like, well, Billy, why does it matter that we do it in this exact order? Mm-hmm. And if I were in Billy's shoes, I wouldn't be able to explain why, but I bet he would. The only thing I can think is that doing it this way seems like they both opened their respective doors at the exact same time.
Right. you know, maybe he had the vocabulary to explain what he's doing, but I also see him not wanting to deign to answer. Uh-huh. Like, I could tell you, but I don't have to tell you.
Yeah.
Right. Make me tell you. Okay, why don't you come across this room and make me explain to you why we're cutting it this way?
Yeah. It's Owen Roizman, and he's like, hey, I just need to know, I just want to know, the motivation behind these cuts. And Billy's like, okay, well, let me show you. Here's a picture. What do you see there? It's like, oh, that's a lovely bird. It's like, what's it doing? It's in the sky. Yeah. Give me a verb. What's it doing in the sky? It's flying. Excellent. Wonderful. Okay. Now what's over there on craft services? It's like, oh, those are donuts. Yeah. And then he walks over to it. And he rolls it across the floor to Owen Roizman. And before it even taps Owen Roizman's shoe and settles like a penny.
Right.
You know, going da 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 da. Right? Mm-hmm. Except in donut sound. Owen Roizman already understands right. what Billy is trying to say.
Yeah.
But yeah. But did you get that feeling too? The way that this is intercut, mm-hmm. it's like they opened the door. Like the moment she opened the door, he also opened the door. We could only see one of them.
Yes, it is asking us, if we're watching it the wrong way, as we are doing it, it's asking us to strain our credulity that Damien is walking up the stairs, does not hear the doorbell, right? Gets upstairs, which is like within earshot at the very least, if not that he's able literally to see the door open and that Kinderman is there, right? But so we're asking you to make these big leaps here and just to accept that these scenes are happening at the same time, that they're opening the door at the same time, even if you were to actually structure them together, and of course Chris gets to her door first or whatever.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I like to think that that's going to be my headcanon.
Yes, absolutely.
That they open the door. Yeah.
Yes. That is what is communicated to us. Whether, you know, if you were to try to strip it together and put it together on a timeline, it doesn't work. But that is what it has to be. That's what it has. Yeah. It feels like that way, and that's what it has to be communicated to us.
Yeah. Yeah. So from here we cut, and it's another close up on Dimmy, and Keenan. The first thing I thought of here. Remember way back in the Dr. Klein episodes, we had a shot of Klein looking at Reagan. Mm-hmm. It was actually in this room. I think right before he gets backhanded by Howdy.
He was like,
keep away, this hour's mine, right? There was a shot of Dr. Klein. And Keenan, you had said it looked like he was the hero of the movie.
Right.
He was the big, strong man coming in to save these ladies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gets tall in the frame, and the camera now adjusts to him instead of Chris. Like, it's framing him instead of her, and that's something we've done before. And it's like, here he is. Mm-hmm. He's come to save the day.
Yep. And yeah, we very quickly see that that's not the case, right? He gets slapped across the room by Captain Howdy. Mm-hmm. But going back to how he was shot, folks, think of Dimmy. Like, throughout this film, we have seen Dimmy, who is objectively more physically imposing and all around just more of the hero type, right? Mm-hmm. Continually lit or shot or put into scenes so as to downplay these qualities. Of the three characters, he is the strongest physically. He is the most physically fit. We joke about him looking like Rocky. We even speculated that Stallone got some ideas from this movie. Damien Karras is our sexy badass hero Dr. Priest, who just happened to be put in the wrong movie, who just happens to have been put in a series of situations that strip him of his heroic powers, and we rag on Dimmy for being weak or lacking faith or being unprepared, but that's only because we haven't seen anyone else try to do what Dimmy is doing. And I think if we did, we could see just how strong Dimmy has been. The fact that he's still here, that's something I can't stress enough. I love Father Dyer, but I can see Father Dyer, I can see Birmingham, I can see Bishop Michael himself noping out of this way earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Of those three, I feel like the strongest would be Dyer, but I don't think he has seen enough darkness. I don't think he lays awake at night and asks the same questions that Dimmy does. Mm-hmm. And I think Howdy would surprise him with those questions.
Well, Howdy wouldn't have fun with Dyer, because Dyer has not been thinking those questions the same way Timmy has.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I started trying to make one point and then I went in a whole nother direction. what I'm saying is Dimmy is our guy.
Yep.
But this movie, these events have tried to keep him down, to make him seem like he is not our guy until, and now I'm bringing it back to this minute, you get a shot like this close-up of Dimmy in the doorway, this face as he looks into the room. This is our hero face, brows furrowed, dark eyes shining. We know what he's looking at right now because we've seen the movie, and he's not looking at it the way we expect Dimmy to look at it. Up to this point, we've seen close-ups of him looking at his mother in the hospital bed, or reacting to something Howdy said, or something Marin said, and all of those close-ups show a very vulnerable Dimmy. We've also seen shots of him wearing that mask to avoid being vulnerable, mm-hmm. avoid those strong feelings. But here, in this close-up, we see sort of the best of both of these extremes. We see concern, but we also see the reining in of emotion and a clear head because action may be needed. He's allowing himself to feel, but he's not allowing himself to be overwhelmed by it. Mm-hmm. And he's also not disconnecting completely. He's exactly where he needs to be. And on top of that, his face also looks more mature.
And that's what Book Kinderman from the reading you just did says about Damien, right? In addition to you need to calm down, et cetera. He, when he mentions, your director, Elia Kazan, that's him telling him that he looks like John Garfield and not like Sal Mineo anymore.
Right.
So that's him going back and saying no, you do look like that boxer. You don't look like a kid anymore. Like the last time that we even met.
Yeah. So what do you think of this shot, Keenan? Like, does this kind of match have we finally given the hero shot to, the right person? Is this the same type of shot that we had given to Dr. Klein before when we placed him as the hero?
Yeah, I think we had, I like that shot behind Damien as he's walking into the hallway as the hero shot. And then you pointed out, the last time we saw that, right, which was a little bit darker, he gets in there, but then he sees his mother and it doesn't happen. And this time we get to that same shot of him out in the hallway. It's the hero shot, his cloak, flapping in the wind or whatever, right? And he's going up there like a gunslinger. And then this time we get to the shot. And I think it is happening here.
Okay.
So now this is the time.
Yes. All right. And folks, in the last minute, we played with the idea that as soon as Dimmy said no to Chris's question of whether Reagan was going to die, that was the moment that Marin died and Dimmy became the exorcist. Mm. Whether that's true or not, I agree with our buddy Alex Bledsoe when he said that that was the moment that the mantle of hero is passed to Dimmy. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that here in this shot.
Yeah, one last interesting thing here for me is that his collar is the white part of his collar is kind of poking out, is sort of disheveled a little bit. So like when we had Father David Mowry on, he said that he would tell his seminary students, right, you're not fully dressed. So Marin has that. And I went back and looked in the previous scene. It's there. It's fine. So again, this is just sort of this emotional effect. It doesn't make any logical sense. He didn't get it loose just by doing that cool walk up the hallway.
Right.
It's he's so badass that's popping his collar out. But I like this look here that he's ready to go, but there's just something still a little bit askew.
Yep, yep, yep.
Oh, and we're saying that he's going to be the hero now, but he's going to do some things maybe that we don't agree with heroically. So, yeah.
Yes.
Damien Karras's actions do not reflect the opinions of the Exorcist Minute.
Yeah. And we're gonna talk about that in the next minute. Oh, boy. Okay. Yeah. Keenan, I never asked you what you think of the next minute.
Well, we'll find out next time.
Yeah, yeah. Whew, yeah, yeah, we'll all find out together. Oy. But like in this minute right now, we linger on Dimmy. He takes a breath and he begins to move. We cut, and it's as if we're looking at the scene through his point of view. The camera is circling the bottom left bedpost. First thing we see is Father Marin collapsed face down on the bed. His head is turned away from us. We also notice that the bed is oddly empty. Where's Ray? And then just out of the corner of our eye, we see what might be some hair. And we realize that Reagan is sitting up in bed, not just sitting up, but on the complete other side of the bed to where she must have gotten loose from the straps. But perhaps this cut happens too fast for us to register any of that. All we really have time to see is Marin.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know if we were supposed to notice it, that Reagan is there, but on this watch, right, you do notice it. We do at least, and we're not used to seeing her on that side of the bed, right? She's essentially facing inward. She's at the foot of the bed and facing what has been established as inward, because the bed has been a stage for her, right? This right. Reagan demon, and she's always on stage looking out at us and the people in the audience as her audience, right?
Right.
So now it's totally, she's got her back to the stage, right? Mm-hmm. And she's looking in. It's like, oh, what is it? That's even scarier now, right? Just we've broken the pattern. And then when we do go to the other side and we see her, it's like she's in her corner in a boxing ring, right? Like she's we'll talk about that in a second, but she's not on stage.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh my God. I didn't even put that together. Yep. Yeah. It is like a boxing ring. Oh, Jesus. Next minute, folks. Okay. So we cut and we are now looking into the room, almost as if we are standing where Dimmy had been standing just a moment ago. But Dimmy has rushed over to Marin. He reaches down, grabs Marin, and as soon as he pulls him up, we see that it is too late. Marin looks pale and dead. I know I said this back when he was slammed against the wall. It's just something about the lighting and how his artificially whitened hair looks so brittle in these moments as opposed to other moments. The Roman ritual falls back onto the bed as Dimmy struggles with this heavy body.
Yeah, so Damien pulls Marin up because Marin is face down on the bed, and he pulls him up, and the Roman ritual rests on Marin's chest for a while with the big cross on it. And so it looks like, you know, like him holding flowers or just give it helps us with the idea of him being dead a little bit. And if you look incorrectly to break the movie like we're doing, this is actually heavily choreographed because Jason Miller, as he pulls Max von Sydow out from the bed, has to put his hand onto the book in order to pull it up properly so that it's staged there specifically for a few seconds. And Jason Miller lets go of the book that causes that effect. So that's a heavily choreographed thing that just looks like, you know, like it just happenstance.
Oh, well, I am glad I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
And the next time we record, I'm going to be focusing on other minutes. So, yeah. And by that time, hopefully I'll have forgotten it when I watch it next.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, interesting. Okay. So they wanted the book to kind of like rest on this black cassock background.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also to have that falling effect, because if he really just picked up von Sydow by the shoulder, the book would just stay on the bed.
Exactly, yeah. Huh, okay.
So it gives us the feeling that, like, von Sydow is dropping the book.
Yes.
Even though he's not, yeah. Miller is dropping the book.
So he lays him back down on the ground, and here we cut. We're on the ground with Marin, with this corpse. Between us in the foreground is his bottle of holy water laying on its side, still half filled as the water...
Or half empty.
Or half empty, depending. As I was reading that... No, no, I'm not going to lie. As I was writing that, days ago, I was like, one of us, is going to say it.
Yeah, we just know each other too well at this point.
Yeah. But yeah, but I decided not to say it. Because I was trying to conjure up imagery of this holy water bottle mm-hmm. bleeding out onto the floor.
Yeah. Hey, man. Drops. It's still there. Yeah. It's still there.
Yeah. We did both.
Yeah, but I would
we got we got our ice cream and curry.
You see the holy water as half full.
Yeah.
I see it as half empty.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it was like I see the holy water as half full. Mm-hmm. You see the holy water as water. Okay. But yeah, so Dimmy gets Marin to the floor and begins unbuttoning his cassock.
Mm-hmm.
And from here we cut to Reagan / Howdy sitting up in the bed, wrists unbound, but with the straps still hanging off of them. That's such a great effect. You see mm-hmm. that in like all of her depictions, right? Like all those like animatronic dummies and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you know, around Halloween time, you go to one of those big superstores and you're walking through the aisles and she just goes bah! And she jumps out at you and you
right.
and you get really really angry. Even though you shouldn't, because you were actually scared by it.
Right.
And people saw you get scared by a dumb toy.
That you should have known was going to jump at you.
Right.
Why else would they buy the toy?
And you punch the toy in the face repeatedly.
Repeatedly.
Repeatedly. Until they escort you out. No. With the toy, because you break it, you buy it.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so the straps are still hanging from the unbound wrists, and she's just leaning casually against the bottom left bedpost, elbow propped on the footboard, and wearing the strangest expression yet. Keenan, what is this look that she has given us? I see curiosity. I see interest. She is fascinated by what she is seeing. It looks almost like Billy was shooting a different scene, one that Linda Blair wasn't in, and she was just off to the side watching Jason Miller and Max von Sydow work. But then, like Billy just like swiveled the camera and caught her expression while she was watching them. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not it, but but like the casual curiosity, as if Howdy is watching two bugs do something interesting. It's mm-hmm. it's comical, and because of that, it's also very disturbing. Like,
yeah,
what do you think?
Yeah, maybe they just put the Flying Nun on TV for Linda Blair there, and she just becomes a zombie like parents of the 70s would be afraid that their children would turn into by watching television. But.
I mean, it's not, that's what happens to me when I'm watching, I mean, you know how sometimes you'll kind of like zone out and, it'll be like the screen will be black.
Right.
Right. And you'll just see your face. This is the meme. Have you seen the meme
of this look? No.
No, there's a meme of the Captain Howdy face,
mm-hmm.
and it just says your face when Netflix asks you if you're still watching. Right.
Right.
And I think all of us just kind of like, man, I would never want to see myself watching something.
Mm-hmm. Or playing a video game.
Or playing a video game. Right. I know I would just have the dopiest look.
Right.
My eyes would cross slightly and my tongue would just hang out a little bit.
Yeah, he's got that Candy Crush look on him.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the dumbest things.
Yeah. Somehow the Next Generation has made that into like a marketable thing. I don't know.
Yeah, but here it's so interesting. You know, again, she looks tired, right? In addition to everything they're looking at. But yeah, just casual is such a good word for it. Like, how long has she been sitting there, right? So like, we're reading it as Marin has just died a couple of, you know, minutes ago, like maybe 90 seconds ago, right?
Right, right.
But she's looking at him as if that's not the case, that it's much longer, and she's just been sitting there and she doesn't know what to do. Now, I don't know. Are you going to talk about what has happened here, like according to the book or according to the script?
Oh, that's, yeah, I have the reading for the next minute.
All righty. Yeah, so we'll save that here because, yeah, in the script, the Reagan demon has some ideas about what has happened and has opinions about what has happened here.
Yes. It's very different from how it plays out in the movie.
Yes.
I'm excited to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And get your read on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that would not occur to me at all watching the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, so back to this shot of Reagan / Howdy in our film. Keenan, it's also just the casual reveal that she is no longer tied down.
Mm-hmm.
I love how underplayed that is. We made such a big deal about those straps. They were the only thing keeping us safe. Again, going back to Hannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs, right? He is bound. He is restrained. He is contained for that entire movie. Mm-hmm. And the implication is that if you make even the tiniest mistake with him, you are dead.
Right.
And here it's like the same thing, except Dimmy either doesn't realize or doesn't care.
Yeah. He needs to go save his father, right? So he's not thinking where he should be thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, getting back to this idea, I like that, like, Howdy is relaxing or, you know, recuperating in her corner, right? Mm, in her corner of the boxing ring, right?
Right.
And it's like, okay, well, you know, maybe depending on what other information you have, maybe something bad has happened where Howdy is unhappy, or maybe Howdy has won or whatever, but also just resting, like preparing for the next round, right? So not celebrating, not like, hoo-hoo, I did this or anything like that.
Right.
And then also not like hereditarying up into the ceiling or something and I don't want you to see this. Just here I am, I'm resting. It's just casual, like, you know, next round is going to come up.
Right. And kind of also just wondering what Karis is going to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do bugs think of? What do sea sponges, what are they like out in the wild? And she's like, that's interesting.
Yeah. she probably watched Marin die, watched his last breaths.
Uh-huh.
Right. And it like it was a Netflix show. It's like, right. Huh.
Huh.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. True crime.
And then, yeah. And then Karis comes in. He's like, oh, season two.
That's right.
Yeah. But yeah, so from here, we cut back. Dimmy undoes the cassock and feels for signs of life. And then he begins to violently pound Marin's chest with his clasped fists. Mm-hmm. It's a... God, we can... I cannot describe this action without saying double axe handle.
I think that's right.
Yeah, right? He raises them up and he slams them back down like seven times, during which we have now cut to a close-up of Marin's dead face, showing us that Dimmy's actions have no effect. Keenan, I looked all over. What is it that he is doing? Is it like this can't be the 1970s version of CPR?
No, I don't believe so. No. But let me look. I have here. Yeah. CPR training guides from the 60s. So that's what Karis would have been trained on. And no, it's what we think of today. You know, one using the butt of one palm, pushing into the back of the other hand to push its palm into the chest. Yeah. So this is not CPR. No.
And he's not like he's not trying to restore breath. He's trying to like resuscitate the heartbeat.
I just think he's just upset. I don't think this is his medical training at all. Absolutely not.
I can only read it as him maybe incorrectly trying something medical, but I have, like, you know, I'll be darned if I know.
Like, yeah, I don't like think this
what,
is anything.
What medical school?
Right. This isn't him slightly off in his training. This is just, I think, emotional acting out of like, no, man, don't do this to me, man. Right. I think that's all that is. I don't think it's anything medical.
It's so specific, though.
Yeah.
Like the pose that he does, it looks like he is. You know, and he's like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Like he's, and then he leans down and he checks for signs of life again.
Mm-hmm.
Like it, folks, yeah, help us out. Like, what the hell is he doing here? Like, is it that, you know, his emotions got the better of him and he's just like pounding on Marin's chest, or is he trying something that we are unaware of?
7 double axe handles to the chest, in 2.5 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, because CPR is supposed to be once per second, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, no.
You know, actually, so for CPR, did you know about this?
Mm-hmm.
I forget what it is now. It's either one or the other, but at one time it was you have to do it to a certain rhythm.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. they all just like unanimously, it's like universally like understood that it has to be this song. Do you know what the song is?
Staying Alive.
Yeah,
Staying Alive. Because you go, staying alive, staying alive. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really smart idea. There must be other songs that obviously are in that tempo, but that's the one that, like, yeah.
Right.
It's easier to teach.
Yeah. One of my favorite comedians, Dara O'Brien, he actually made a joke about this. He said that, I think... He said that recently they changed it to Nelly the Elephant.
But then what? They have to teach us all whatever Nelly the Elephant song is?
I think it's more well known over there, Nelly the Elephant. I've never heard of Nelly the Elephant.
I've never heard of Nelly the Elephant. We should probably look it up.
Yeah, we should. Yeah. But he did a whole thing. He was like, that just ruins the seriousness of the whole situation. Just imagine, you know, it's you're in a crowded place and you're like, back away. Nelly the Elephant.
Well, let me listen to this a little bit.
Okay.
To Bombay, a traveling circus came. They brought an intelligent elephant, and Nelly was her name. This is very English.
Yeah. See, I knew there was a reason we hadn't heard it. But yeah, all that to say, folks, no idea what he's doing here. Wish I knew. Keenan, you think it's him losing control?
I think it's just incohate rage at, you know,
okay,
at losing Marin. Yeah.
I mean, like I'm not disagreeing that he does lose control, but I think it looks and feels like something medical that's not working, that he's losing Marin because he did it wrong, because nobody's ever done it that way. Dimmy, what are you doing?
Well, I hope no doctors do that to you.
Yeah.
Because look what it does. It kills Marin.
Mm-hmm. He wakes up just slightly. He's, what's up?
So, yes, we are being hard on Dimmy, et cetera, as we've said in the past couple of minutes. But Marin dies because Marin sends Damien away, because Damien is messing around with his mama issue cosplaying, right? So this is all Damien's fault from his perspective.
Oh, from Damien's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
yeah, he
okay.
left, and yeah, he's only out of the room because he got sent out because he couldn't hack it.
But
and then Marin died.
But objectively, this is Marin's fault.
Well, Damien doesn't know anything about Marin's heart condition.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's like I'm talking about like you and me. Like, this is Marin's fault.
Why is it Marin's fault? Well,
I don't know. I just feel bad for piling more on Dimmy. We're gonna there's some things in the next minute that we're gonna, you know, he's gonna get plenty of. Ooh, folks, if you thought we were hard on Dimmy before. Yeah,
we're going to spend the last movie minutes of his life being hard on him again.
Oh, geez. Oh. Well, but that's why I included the book.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, okay. So whatever it is that Dimmy is doing, it is not working.
Agreed.
Dimmy bends down to listen to Marin's heart. We cut back to Howdy, a little closer on him now, as he continues to watch with interest. Another cut back to the floor, looking up at Dimmy as he continues listening for a heartbeat. Then, the slow realization, he raises his head from Marin's chest, and he looks with anguish into his foster father's dead face. From here, we cut immediately to Howdy, now laughing quietly. It's the famous shot where Reagan's hands are clasped in front of her chin, the demon eyes are wide and staring, her scarred cheeks raised in a smile. I think, for me, the most disturbing part of this is how childlike it still looks, how cherubic with those like chubby cheeks, but then you just got those demon eyes up above those chubby cheeks, right? Mm-hmm. And the sound, too, like the way that she laughs, right? You almost expect the laugh of a demon to be a little bit more immature, right? This seems more like how Reagan might laugh.
Right.
But then you think, of course, he's using her body. But, you know, he's given us like looks or said things in such a way before that look and sound different from Reagan. So I sort of expected this laugh to be a little bit more subdued, maybe not even a laugh, maybe just like a little, huh, you know, or something like that. Just a smirk or something, right? Mm-hmm. But seeing him laugh in this way, it's almost like he is now completely absorbed into her. Like they have become one. Or it could be that he's laughing in Reagan's voice specifically to mock.
That's what I read it as. I think that's my favorite interpretation of this because, yeah, like, so why does he talk in Mishay's McCambridge's voice? Because that bothers them, right? It bothers them more to hear this masculine voice come out of this little girl.
Right.
He could do anything. He could talk in Mama's voice. He could talk in Burke's voice. He could talk in Reagan's voice for sure. So then this is a time where it would bother him the most to hear Reagan's voice doing this, right?
Yeah.
Because it also is, you know, hey, you've been trying to protect this little girl, et cetera, not handing her over to the police, even though she has murdered Burke Dennings. And you found that out, you know, at the act break. You've known that for quite some time now.
Yeah.
Right. And now here she is and she's murdered Father Marin while you were away. Right. And so it's the little girl voice again.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. So this laughter gets Dimmy's attention. We cut to a close-up as Dimmy turns from Marin to look at Howdy. And I paused it here because this is where our minute ends. Mm-hmm. And his face is scary. There is something going on. Realization is dawning. But also I think we're seeing what that mask was trying to keep from us this entire movie, like the full flood of his emotions are right behind his eyes and the set of his jaw ready to explode.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk more about that in the next minute. But for now, those are all my notes. Keenan, is there anything else?
No, I think we got it.
Okay, folks, this has been another excellent Exorcist Minute. I've been Lester Ryan Clark. You can reach me on all the socials as Lester Ryan Clark.
And I've been Keenan Diaz. You can find me on Letterboxd and Instagram at Howdy Keenan.
Yeah, we got our listener group, Compelling Conversations. Go check that out and request to join, and we'll let you in here with us. Thank you so much to everyone who has shared the show by word of mouth or on social media, and a big thank you to everyone who has given us a 5-star ratings on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to our show. We really appreciate it. It's going to help our little podcast grow and find more cool people like you. Okay, Keenan, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I think I am, Lester.
Folks, until next time,
the power of knock-knock jokes compels you. All right, so yeah, I've looked up this guy in Macbeth, and he does say that knock knock. Here's his second knock knock joke.
Hmm.
Are you ready? This porter from Macbeth.
Okay.
Knock knock. Who's there? In the other devil's name, faith. Here's an equivocator that could swear in both the scales against either scale. Who committed treason enough? For God's sake, it could not equivocate to heaven.
Faith hears an equivocator that could swear in both the scales against either scale, who committed treason enough for God's sake, yet could not equivocate to heaven, who?
See, these were a riot right from the beginning.
They were. Oh, my God. My sides are hurting right now.
All right. This is a 1929 children's knock-knock joke.
Oh, this... Just that combination.
This is what
children's knock knock jokes and 1929.
This is what children
is the first. It was like knock knock. Who's there? Coal lung.
That's right.
You have coal lung.
Right. Scarlet fever. Who's there? Scarlet fever or the mumps, we can't tell. All right. This is from a game of Buff. It's a 1929 children's game.
Okay.
All right. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Buff.
Buff who?
Buff says buff to all his men, and I say buff to you again.
Keenan, I've been meaning to chat with you about something.
Is it about, what is it about?
I'm really happy that you found this new hobby of telling people knock-knock jokes. It seems to be bringing you a lot of joy.
Yes, a lot of joy. So here is here is stand-up comic Melissa Doughty's recollection of the first joke she ever told. She said this in 2015. She said this is the first joke she ever told when she was 4.
Uh-huh.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse who?
Mickey Mouse's underwear. This is from an NPR article on the history of knock knock jokes.
I love how it still manages to get you, you know?
You know, it just form over function, yeah. It just the form.
Yeah. We do you have any more?
Oh, yes. This is from Constance Gerhard's bridge column in the Reading Times in July 31st, 1936.
Oh.
All right. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Tarzan.
Tarzan who?
Tarzan stripes forever.
Did you hear that little gasp, folks, as I as I got it?
It took a while, huh? It's a thinker.
It took a while.
A real thinker.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm.
Okay.
Okay.
This is the last one.
Uh-huh.
This is from the Delaware County Daily Times.
Uh-huh.
I guess it's from 2015.
Okay.
Okay. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Teresa.
Teresa who?
Teresa Crowd. Like Three's Company, come and knock at my door. Come and knock at my door.
Even today it's all knocking.
For you. Even there were kids for
everything.
On and on and Three's Company too.
Oh my God, Father Merritt's coming. We gotta make like I'm just a very sick girl. Everybody help me out. Chrissy!
What's going on in here?
Oh, hello. Bygone era landlord or neighbor. I can't remember.
I don't remember. Don Donuts.
Yes.
I'm the second neighbor guy, not Mr. Roper.
No, not yet. Mr. Roper's not here anymore. That's why you're here.
What happened to Mr. Roper?
You asked too many questions, okay?